Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. A troubling report. Employment numbers in the United States fall short of expectations as workers continue to leave their jobs in the wake of the pandemic. Then, a victory for journalism. The Nobel Peace Prize is awarded to news editors from Russia and the Philippines for their reporting in the face of political repression.
When the state's power is focused on journalists, that the way you fight back is by doing your job.
And it's Friday. David Brooks and Karen Tumulty consider debt ceiling negotiations and new revelations about former President Trump's efforts to overturn the 2020 election. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. September's disappointing U.S. jobs report is further proof of the pandemic's grip on the economy. The Labor Department today reported U.S. employers added just 194,000 jobs last month. That's the fewest since December. Even so, the unemployment rate dropped sharply to 4.8%, down from 5.2% in August. We'll have more on all this after the news summary. The average daily number of COVID-19 cases in the U.S. has dipped below 100,000 for the first time since early August. Meanwhile, COVID vaccinations have hit a three-month high, nearly a million per day, due in part to employers requiring them. In Afghanistan, a suicide bombing at a Shiite Muslim mosque in the northern city of Kunduz killed at least 46 people and wounded dozens more. The Islamic State claimed responsibility. Shattered glass and debris were strewn across the mosque floor as people worked to cover victims and remove bodies.
It was around 1:40 p.m. All the Muslims had gathered in the mosque for Friday prayers, and then I heard the explosion. I was nearby, and what I saw was just like the end of the world. Why is this happening to Muslims?
The Islamic State has been behind a spike in recent attacks since U.S. and NATO forces left Afghanistan in August. Nearly 140 countries have agreed to set a global minimum tax rate of 15% on big multinational companies. The tentative deal would prevent companies like Facebook and Google from profiting in low-tax countries. President Biden welcomed the agreement and said that it will, quote, even the playing field for American workers. President Biden has rejected former President Trump's request to withhold White House records from a congressional probe into the January 6th Capitol attack. That paves the way for the National Archives to release the documents to the House January 6th committee. Meanwhile, Mr. Trump's former aide, Steve Bannon, said that he will defy a subpoena from the House committee. President Biden restored to protected status three national monuments cut by former President Trump. They include Bear's Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante in Utah and the Northeast Canyons and Seamounts National Monument off the New England coast. Mr. Trump had opened up some of those areas to mining and development. President Biden formally reversed that decision during a White House ceremony.
National Monument and parks are part of the identity as our identity as a people. There are more than natural wonders. They're the birthright we pass from generation to generation, a birthright of every American.
Some of the lands in Utah are considered sacred to Native American tribes. Today's move also prevents commercial fishing at the Marine Conservation Area off the coast of New England. There is word that President Biden will raise the cap on refugees to 125,000 for fiscal year 2022. That nearly doubles what it was for the previous fiscal year. The increase will follow through on a campaign promise he made to take in more refugees after the cap fell to a historic low under his predecessor. Two wealthy parents accused of buying their children's way into elite universities were found guilty today by a federal jury in Boston. It is the first case to go to trial in the college admissions scandal that erupted over 2 years ago. 57 people have been charged in the scheme. Federal prosecutors have decided not to pursue charges against the white Wisconsin police officer who shot Jacob Blake, a black man, last year. They said there is not enough evidence to prove that the officer used excessive force or violated Blake's civil rights. Blake is now paralyzed from the waist down. In Nigeria, security forces have rescued 187 people in one of the country's largest hostage liberations. The victims were abducted by armed bandits in the northwestern state of Zamfara. The hostages, including children and babies, were held captive in a remote forest for weeks. Police officials said no ransom money was paid. And September's weak jobs report pushed stocks lower on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 8 points to close at 34,746. The Nasdaq fell 74 points, and the S&P 500 slipped 8. Still to come on the NewsHour, the Nobel Peace Prize is awarded a journalist from Russia and the Philippines. Former White House Russia expert Fiona Hill explains what she calls Donald Trump's dangerous flaw. Choreographer and activist Bill T. Jones returns to the stage in his largest work yet, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
The U.S. jobs report for September showed COVID continues to disrupt the labor market. The government employment was far lower than expected. One key reason, back-to-school hiring in public schools was lower than usual. But the report also underscores other complications in the labor market. The unemployment rate fell to 4.8%, but that was due in part to people leaving the labor force altogether. Job openings are at a record high, and wages increased again last month as companies tried to attract new employees. More than 25 million people quit their jobs in the first 7 months of this year, and it is now being called the Great Resignation. Our business and economics correspondent Paul Solman explains.
We don't want to do this anymore.
They just didn't care about me anymore.
I'm done. I am not working here anymore. I don't feel safe.
Workers like these are quitting their jobs at the highest rate in 20 years. Because for many of us, the pandemic has prompted a professional reassessment. So says Harvard Business School's Siddhal Neely.
We cannot underestimate the extent to which people have experienced such stress, such anxiety, and a ton of burnout in the last 18, 19 months. That is also driving their interest to say, I don't want this lifestyle as it is. I want to change it.
Georgetown University's Brooks Holtum has long studied worker turnover.
Periodically, people experience shocks that cause them to reconsider how work fits with the rest of their life. All of us for the past 18 months have experienced one of these shocks.
As Microsoft futurist and slipper fan Desmond Dickerson told us back in the spring,
40% of the global workforce intends to leave their job in this coming year.
And ever so many have, led by millennials. In the last year, the rate at which workers ages 30 to 45 resigned rose by over 20%. Some of the hardest hit sectors? Healthcare and tech. The specific reasons, first and foremost, perhaps, burnout.
Your staffing is at an all-time low. The morale is at an all-time low. It's traumatic, it's stressful. We're at a breaking point.
Kalina Surma quit her job as a patient care director at a New York City hospital in August.
It's so distressing. You come to work and you have a skeleton crew and they can't get time off. They can barely even get a lunch break. They come to you asking for, you know, something and you have nothing to offer them. They feel so undervalued. It's hard. It's a tough time.
Across the country, the nursing shortage has become acute.
There was a point where we could not hire nurses who were below a bachelor's degree. Now, just recently, they opened it up to nurses with an associate's degree. So there's a desperation there.
The virus had other frontline workers on edge as well.
When the COVID-19 pandemic hit, it just kind of crystallized a lot of the ways that they don't care about employee safety.
Sam Weston used to work at the front desk of a hotel in Superior, Wisconsin.
I actually took the initiative to place signs around the hotel lobby saying, wear a mask, hey, keep a 6-foot distance. And my hotel management specifically tore those signs down and directly told me not to put those kinds of signs up because it would cause a panic.
Nancy Pasinic Johnson was a librarian on Long Island, New York.
My job was no longer totally focused on librarianship. I started to feel like I was a mom every single day. Pull your mask up. Pull your mask up. Oh, I don't want to wear a mask. Well, I'm sorry, you can't come into the library without a mask on.
A related reason for quitting, lousy employer treatment for lousy pay. Alicia Bowen made $12.50 an hour as a commercial cleaner in Ohio.
Anytime I had a family emergency, I was treated horribly. For example, my husband passed away in 2015. And I called and said that I needed a week off, and they told me how inconvenient it was and that it wasn't going to work out. But it was just years and years of abuse and mistreatment.
The shutdown was the last straw.
I had no backup work, nothing. My hours were cut in half. I felt like this wasn't fair to me. I've been working really hard for these people, sacrificing, and I quit.
Oscar Garcia was a teacher in El Paso, Texas. Teaching online pushed him over the edge, too.
You spend less time teaching in the room and more time documenting contacts with parents, helping students, technical issues. And in hybrid, it became worse because you are now in the room with some students, but some students you're still at home. I was so tired. You're going to hear that a lot from teachers, how exhausting it is.
For Chicago area data analyst Ricardo Martinez, the crunch came from company demands while he worked from home.
I've got one kid crying over here, another kid that's running by and just wants attention.
And then an inflexible supervisor asked why he couldn't make an impromptu online meeting.
And they're like, are you working? I don't understand. It like accentuated all of the feelings I had from before about how work-life balance worked at my work.
Like many other millennials, Martinez reassessed his priorities and resigned.
The corner icon of one.
So did Minneapolis area digital marketer Mark Sen.
Most of my friends are preferring to work remote and have seen kind of a shift in that mentality.
Librarian Johnson and her husband, a paramedic, decided to quit their jobs earlier than planned for a new life on a farm in upstate New York.
We've both been career people for our entire adult lives, and it just got to be too much.
But now a question you may be asking. How can so many people afford to resign? Sam Weston is living off savings as he pursues writing and a freelance career in filmmaking.
I've been investing actually in cryptocurrency a little bit, and that's been increasing the amount of runway that I have.
Seems like a risky way to stay afloat.
It is risky, but it's better than working for somebody else who doesn't care for your health and well-being and who won't give you a leg up to actually do something that feels meaningful.
And if and when he returns to the workforce, Weston will be in a stronger position than before. At the end of July, there were a record 10.9 million job openings. It's an employees' labor market, says Harvard's Sidal Neely.
People have options. And because they have options, their demands and their interests and their tolerance for things that are not aligned with their values on how they want to live their lives, they're going to leave and they're going to look for it elsewhere.
Tech worker Mark Sen got a job right away, but like quite a few resigners, he also has entrepreneurial ambitions.
My new role has given me opportunities to work on my startup, make more money, and it's full-time remote, so I'm able to be at home and really invest in my home space.
Data analyst Ricardo Martinez simply found a better fit.
I wound up finding a company that said, we understand family comes first. And I was able to make a little bit more money as well, but I was not really financially motivated.
Nursing supervisor Kalina Surma.
I resigned for a better position in pay and seemingly a better situation with the staffing and everything, more control that I'll have over that.
Cleaner Alicia Bowen's sister hooked her up with a much better gig.
She works for a bank and they had a cleaning position open, paying $4 more an hour with a 401k benefits and I don't have to drive my car. So I think what I did by quitting kind of did myself a favor, big time.
How come you didn't ask your sister about other possibilities earlier?
I really don't know. I was scared that I wouldn't qualify for anything else or scared that it wouldn't work out. I get stuck in this. I feel like I don't deserve any better. And I do.
And in a reopened economy, employers now scramble to find workers. Their challenge, a labor force that no longer accepts business as usual. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Paul Salmon.
The Norwegian Nobel Committee often appears to make a statement when it awards its annual Peace Prize, and 2021 is no different. Two journalists, Maria Ressa of the Philippines and Dmitry Muratov from Russia, were recipients at a time when the free press is under global attack and the truth is too often hard to find. Nick Schifrin explains.
For a journalist whose government convicted her of crimes to try and force her silence, today was validation.
When the state's power is focused on journalists, that the way you fight back is by doing your job.
For an editor whose newspaper lost six journalists to murder, today was a symbol of journalistic sacrifice.
This award is for our fallen professionals who gave their lives for our profession.
Maria Ressa was a CNN correspondent and Time Person of the Year who started the independent news outlet Rappler in the Philippines.
Shoot and shoot him dead.
Rappler exposed Filipino President Rodrigo Duterte's drug war and its brutality. The UN calls it an extrajudicial, murderous crackdown that's killed 12,000. Duterte also waged war on the media and last year shut down the country's largest broadcaster. Ressa has faced 10 arrest warrants and still has seven legal cases pending.
We are fighting for facts.
Today, in a conversation with a Rappler reporter, she said that those in power and technology companies maintain control not just through the gun, but by manipulating the pen.
When we live in a world where facts are debatable, when the world's largest distributor of news prioritizes the spread of lies laced with anger and hate and spreads it faster and further than facts, then journalism becomes activism. The Nobel Peace Prize Committee realized that a world without facts means a world without truth and trust.
Dmitry Muratov is the longtime editor of Novaya Gazeta, an island of independence in a sea of media silenced or controlled by the Kremlin. Other independent Russian journalists have been detained and outlets banned or declared foreign agents, the same designation given to the country's leading opposition figure, Alexei Navalny.
If I were a member of the Nobel Peace Committee, I would vote for a man the bookmakers bet on. But I think this man has everything ahead of him. And I'm talking about Alexei Navalny.
Novaya Gazeta was in part started with money won by Mikhail Gorbachev for his 1990 Nobel Peace Prize. Today, at first, the Kremlin congratulated Muratov. But then the Justice Ministry labeled more Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and BBC journalists foreign agents. Yesterday was the 15-year anniversary of the murder of Anna Politkovskaya, a Novaya Gazeta journalist who investigated Russian military and intelligence abuses. Today, Nobel Committee Chair Berit Rees-Andersen said that kind of stifling of freedom of expression can stifle peace.
They are representatives of all journalists who stand up for this ideal in a world in which democracy and freedom of the press face increasingly adverse conditions.
And to talk about today's Nobel Peace Prize, I'm joined by Joel Simon, Executive Director of the Committee to Protect Journalists, an independent organization that promotes press freedom worldwide. Joel Simon, welcome back to the NewsHour. We just heard the chairwoman of the Nobel Committee say that journalists around the world face increasingly adverse conditions. So, do they?
Oh, absolutely. This is the worst moment we've ever seen. Record numbers of journalists imprisoned around the world. Every indicator of press freedom suggests that press freedom is in decline almost everywhere. States are deploying violence against journalists. You have the example of Jamal Khashoggi, the Washington Post columnist who was murdered by the Saudi government dismembered and disappeared. So there's an unprecedented wave of violence and repression directed against journalists. Frankly, we've never seen anything like it.
Let's zoom in to Maria Ressa's work and the Philippines. President Duterte says he's going to step down. Does the crackdown that he initiated end with him? Was the crackdown personal? Or, in fact, could the crackdown continue because he has helped it be institutionalized?
He's used systematic campaigns of harassment. He's used social media to spread lies and disinformation. He's waged sort of a frontal assault on critical journalists, including Maria Ressa. So that's an institutionalized practice that probably will outlast him. And it's something we're seeing not just in the Philippines, but in these kinds of modern authoritarian states around the world.
Moving to Russia, there's been an unprecedented attack by the Kremlin on any dissent and any critical media over the last year. Has it worked?
Oh, yeah, it's worked. I mean, I think one of the things you have to recognize about Russia is that while the violence against journalists has declined, I mean, Dmitry Muratov has talked about the warlike casualties that his news organization, Novaya Gazeta, has suffered. But the level of violence has declined somewhat in Russia because the government has become much more adept at deploying kind of bureaucratic and legalistic attacks against journalists. The favorite strategy these days is simply to declare journalists foreign agents for receiving any sort of funding from outside of Russia, and then putting onerous restrictions on them that basically make it impossible for them to operate. So repression is very much alive in Russia. It's just become more institutionalized and sophisticated.
And zooming back out, Maria Ressa talked multiple times today about the importance of facts and the business of facts that we journalists are in. Why is it so important, do you think, that we need to be able to have a common set of facts when we increasingly see efforts that controlling political power is actually controlling information?
Yeah, we're the information age, and we're involved in sort of a millennial struggle over who controls information and who gets to determine our reality. And so journalists are very much a part of that battle, and that's why we're seeing such concerted attacks from governments and other enemies of free expression around the world. But, you know, if you don't have information, if you don't have facts, then you don't have accountability, then you don't have the ability to participate in any sort of political process to determine your own future, to determine your own fate, to expose corruption, to defend your rights. All of these things depend on our ability to access independent information. I mean, look, if you look around the world, look at the challenges we face that the Nobel Committee could have recognized. We're, you know, in the midst of a pandemic, we're confronting climate change. But I think what the Nobel Committee was saying is these global problems are enormous, but we can't really fight back against them without essential information. And that's what journalists provide.
Joel Simon, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Russia expert Fiona Hill captured the nation's attention 2 years ago when she testified during President Trump's impeachment hearing. Now she's out with a new book, There Is Nothing for You Here. I sat down with her this week to discuss her own journey to becoming a presidential advisor and why she fears the U.S. is heading down a dangerous path. Fiona Hill, thank you very much for joining us. Congratulations on the book.
Oh, thanks so much, Judy. It's great to be here.
So people know you as an expert on Russia and on Europe, but this is a book that is built around your personal story, the daughter and the granddaughter of coal miners who, what, overcame obstacle after obstacle to end up advising presidents of the United States. And there was advice that your father gave you when you were younger that you turned into the title of the book.
That's right. When I was leaving high school in 1984 in the northeast of England, there was a massive unemployment crisis, especially for youth. 90% of kids who were leaving school had nothing to go on to immediately. And my dad, you know, was basically talking to me about the future. And he basically said, look, if you want to make something of yourself, you want to pursue an education, you want to find a good job, there's nothing for you here, pet. you're going to have to go somewhere else. Because my hometown, former mining town, a town that had built up around associated industries, you know, very much like many places across the United States in the Midwest or Appalachia, basically was an opportunity desert. And people were going to have to leave in droves from the place to basically get ahead in life. And that was the sad reality of the time.
This is a book of you overcoming, as I said, obstacles, whether it was to getting an education, to getting a job, to getting ahead in this all-male, almost all-male profession. What were the lessons that you took away from that?
Well, there's a series of larger lessons in this that I did find opportunity, and obviously I had some amazing opportunities and a lot of career success. But what I took away from this was the importance of mentorship and also the importance of assistance to give you a hand up, not a handout in life, but a hand up. Because I didn't really do all of this on my own. Of course, I worked hard at school. I was very focused on basically all of my studies. I, you know, wanted to pursue an education as far as it would take me, and it took me to Harvard University and, you know, many other things beside. But all the way along this educational path, I had a grant, I had a subsidy. I graduated without any educational debt at all. But the lesson is that it actually takes a lot of effort to be able to get ahead. And in that period, that's the end of the 20th century, it's even more difficult now at the beginning of the 21st.
How many young people would you say today, in whether it's the United States or Great Britain, have the opportunities that Fiona Hill had?
A lot less than there should be, because you would expect that over the decades since I graduated high school, since 1984, that there would have been a steady progression and improvement of people into education and that opening more doors for opportunity. Well, in fact, there has been an expansion of education, but also a massive expansion of educational debt, because there aren't the grants, there aren't the subsidies that there used to be. And so education is becoming a burden in many respects. And it's putting education out of reach of the people at the lowest income bracket. And what we're seeing now in the US in particular, but also increasingly in the UK, is that education and that line, whether you've gone to a college, a community college, 2-year or a 4-year college, is really a determinant of who you are. It's a determiner of economic class and of, you know, basically the way you're going to vote and where you're likely to live as well.
Of course, Fiona Hill, the reason so many people know you, know your face, is because you were testifying in those first House congressional hearings into former President Trump, impeachment hearings. Why did you go to work in his administration?
Well, first of all, it was in the interests of public service. I'd already been in previous administrations, both the Bush administration and the Obama administration, working as the National Intelligence Officer for Russia. I wrote a book on Vladimir Putin, for example, after I'd left my previous public service, that we were at serious risk of being exploited by the Russian security services. And of course, we saw that in 2016 with the sophisticated influence operation that was launched against the US democratic system and against the US presidency. And I wanted to do something to address that. Of course, things didn't quite go as I hoped they would. National security issues ended up being pushed downwards, and we saw much more of the sort of privatization of foreign policy, the efforts to manipulate national security policy for domestic political purposes that was happening, you know, throughout the whole of that 4 years.
Ultimately, what was your assessment of Donald Trump as a person and as a president?
Well, as a person, he was extremely vulnerable to manipulation. And that became a problem for him as a president. And what I mean by that is he had a very fragile ego. And he was very susceptible to flattery, as well as taking massive offense, as we all saw, to any kind of criticism. So on a personal level, that was also a pretty dangerous flaw. When you're the president of the United States, it becomes a fatal flaw, because President Trump couldn't disassociate or disentangle himself from many of the issues that were the critical ones to address. So when people were concerned about Russian influence in the United States election, he only thought about how that affected him, for example. When people talked about the changes in the US economic structure, he would always think, first of all, about how that might affect him and about how that might affect how people would vote for him. So as a president, he was uniquely preoccupied with himself, not with the country. And that, of course, made all of the problems of intelligence risks even higher, because the Russians or others from the outside could also manipulate those tendencies.
So if you can answer this, is the world safer or is it more dangerous because of his presidency?
Well, I think it's become more dangerous because he was also extremely divisive, because President Trump was very focused on getting reelected. And he wasn't going to do that by appealing to all Americans. He wanted to appeal to a particular base of people who were attracted by his personality, by attracted by the things that he said he was going to do for them. And of course, that's on different parts of the economic scale, on the socioeconomic lower levels. It's for people he said he was going to find them a job. He was going to sort of fix the economy so that they would have jobs. At the top end, among millionaires and billionaires, it was that he was going to protect their fortunes from being from those circles that himself.
What I find so striking is that you weren't so concerned about Donald Trump being controlled by Vladimir Putin, being influenced by Vladimir Putin, as you were concerned about the United States following on the same political path that you've seen Russia follow under Vladimir Putin.
That's absolutely right, because Russia went through a similar wrenching economic period and political period in the 1990s. So Russia had its equivalent of the kind of the Great Recession. And at the end of that decade, President Putin comes in and says, I'm going to fix everything. I'm going to make Russia great again, which, of course, is what President Trump said in 2016. And what Putin did was basically tie himself up into all of these politics. He, of course, has extended his terms in office through amending the Constitution. He can essentially be president until 2036. And Donald Trump has also said that he wants to be president in perpetuity. He wouldn't accept that he lost the 2020 election. He's saying he's going to come back, that he has a right to come back because he was never kicked out of office in the first place. And he's been spreading lies about essentially his own role in the events that we've seen over the last several years, January 6th, for example, and the storming of the Capitol.
Do you believe our democracy is in danger as a result of this?
And I think that danger is increasing by the day, because we're constantly seeing other political figures trying to emulate Trump. We're now in a situation where lies and deceit have become the coin of governance.
It's a disturbing conclusion in this book. Fiona Hill, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Judy. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
It has been a whirlwind of a week here in Washington, with the U.S. Supreme Court kicking off its October session, a new report on election interference being issued by the Senate, and a temporary deal reached on the federal debt ceiling. To help us make sense of it all, we are joined by Brooks and Tumulty. That is New York Times columnist David Brooks and Karen Tumulty, columnist for The Washington Post. Very good to have you both with us. Jonathan Capehart is away tonight. Happy to see you both on this Friday night. But let's talk first, David, about what they've done in the Congress and the Senate. They've kicked the can down the road. Enough Republicans gave the Democrats the votes they needed to go ahead and move the debt ceiling decision to December. Is it going to be any easier then?
No. This is what happens when politicians play hand grenade with the nation's solvency. But it's, you know, it's as if the political campaign is running all year round now, or all lifelong, because it's all about positioning for the next election. So the Republicans would love to see the Democrats on a straight party line basis expand the debt ceiling, and then they could blame them for all the spending. And Mitch McConnell was sort of backing them up to do it. And then he sort of blinked, and I think there are two main reasons he blinked. One, there was some threat that the Democrats were so panicked by this, they were going to change the filibuster, which the Republicans desperately do not want them to do. There was some possibility they were just trying to ease some pressure on Joe Manchin, look after their buddy Joe Manchin, who's taking a lot of heat from more progressive Democrats. And then some possibility that Schumer didn't have 50 votes to raise the debt ceiling, in which case we would have gone into insolvency. So we're going to go through all this again in December.
Is December going to be different?
December is going to be different because they will also, in that same little window, have to vote on the continuing resolution. This is the bill that keeps the government operating. So we may have, within a few days of each other, these two difficult votes, one to keep spending and the other to keep borrowing.
And Karen, what about, I mean, David mentioned this, as some people are saying, including former President Trump, saying Mitch McConnell folded. What happened here?
I, all along, was a little skeptical that Mitch McConnell was going to be willing to take the fall for making essentially the entire world economy collapse. He had some leverage, as too often happens in Washington. You know, there's a deal right before the deadline. But I do think we ought to think about whether we ought to even have this whole exercise of raising the debt ceiling. It is something that is meaningless in the context of controlling spending, because you're basically paying bills for spending you've already done. There's a budget process. There's an appropriations process. If you want to have fiscal discipline, that's where to do it. I think they ought to just suspend the debt ceiling indefinitely.
And which is, I guess, an argument that the Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen's been making. But David, I mean, are there clear winners and losers coming out of this, or is it just muddied? Is the picture just muddied?
I'd say muddied. I think each party got a little of what they wanted. The Democrats got the Republicans to actually have a vote and produce some votes. And the Republicans got the idea that we're just going to go through this again. Everyone's a hypocrite on matters of procedure. So whether you're short some filibuster or the debt limit, it all depends on whether you're in the majority or the minority. The Democrats, I think in 2006, wasn't quite the same circumstance, very similar circumstance. They were very happy to let the Republicans take the fall and be the ones to pass the debt limit, including Joe Biden. And now the shoe's on the other foot, so they've all 180-degree changed their positions. And this is the way it always is on these procedural game-playing things, that you do what's in your best interest at this moment. There are no actually principled players in any of this.
Does one side come out stronger or not?
No. It is really a situation of, people seem to think this debt ceiling vote is some kind of political liability. I have never heard any campaign where it becomes an issue or the subject of an ad. The size of the social spending package that the Democrats are talking about, that is likely to figure in the 2022 campaign. But this is just this kabuki theater that they do over and over and over again.
All right, moving on to something we just heard, Fiona Hill, who's written a book about her experiences, David. And that is a number of developments this week about election interference in 2020. You had this disturbing report come out from the Senate Judiciary Committee about the lengths former President Trump went to try to get the Justice Department to overturn the election result. Then you have watching state after state say they want to reform the way they count votes, the way they run their elections. How worried should the American people be right now about all of this?
I'm pretty worried on a scale of 1 to 10, 7.5 or so. That's pretty worried. I'm not a worrying kind of guy, but I think I'm worried about two things. One, we keep learning more and more that Trump really wanted to overturn the election. He wanted to take away the election. And we also learned that throughout the administration, throughout some of the Republican secretaries of state, there were honest people who were not going to let him do it. And so we've learned from the Senate report that he was threatening to fire the Attorney General, and there were enough people in the Justice Department said, we'll all quit at once if you do this. And so he didn't really have the chance. But the more dangerous thing is what's happening in the states now, is that we're setting ourselves up for this all to happen in 2024 if he runs again, and if he's anywhere close. And this time he'll have had not a couple weeks to prepare to take the election away, he will have had years. And the party seems to be extremely focused on this process. And so that's the thing we're worried about.
Where should the concern be focused in all of that? There are so many moving parts to this. Right?
Well, the pattern of the Trump presidency is with these revelations, you always hear something else happen that is both shocking and unsurprising and even predictable about Donald Trump. And there were a few people that stood in the way. Dan Quayle, who talked to Mike Pence about his lack of powers to overturn the election on January 6th, was not on my bingo card for the savior of democracy. But the next year, we're going to have the midterms. And these races in the states where governors may be replaced by governors who would be fine with letting partisan hacks control elections, secretaries of state, election officials, I think the danger in 2024 is going to be a lot higher even than it was in 2020. And we may once again have Donald Trump back on the scene.
And I was going to say whether he's on the ballot. I mean, David, you read that portion of the Senate report where for hour after hour there was an argument inside the White House with then-President Trump saying we need to replace the acting attorney general in order to overturn the election. I mean, they had to argue him down from
this. The most chilling quote, and that was Jeffrey Rosen, the acting attorney general, one thing we know is you, Rosen, aren't going to do anything to overturn the election. That is what the president of the United States said to his acting attorney general.
Right. And so the good news is there were enough. I guess what strikes me, and this is the underlying problem, is that anytime Rudy Giuliani or anybody could come up with a crackpot rationale to do this, they seized on it without any evidence. There was never a moment when people in Trump world said, that theory is a little wacky. They seized on absolutely everything. And that is what happens when you're in a post-truth world.
And if President Trump is not on the ballot, Karen, there's still concern that people who espouse his philosophy and who deny the election result in 2020 could be pushing some of the same.
Exactly. And these are people running up and down the ballot. It has become, practically an article of faith in the Republican Party that if you want to have a shot at elective office, that you have to say these things that really undermine the integrity of the electoral system.
59% of Republicans in one poll said that believing the election was stolen was an important part about being a Republican. It's central to the identity. It's not belief in free markets or being socially conservative. From philosophical and principled positions has gotten to Trump positions. And so the identity of the party has fundamentally changed from a conservative party to a Trump party, at least among, say, half of the Republicans.
Last thing I want to make time for, Karen, and that is the Supreme Court reconvening this week. A lot of eyes watching this institution because they are taking up hot-button issues, abortion, gun rights, and others, maybe affirmative action. What are you looking for from this term? And, people are starting to say, if the court does what we think it could do, this is going to look like a partisan court.
It's certainly, I think this is the term in which the heavily conservative Supreme Court is going to truly show us who they are and what they think. And I think the biggest issue on the plate is whether or not they overturn Roe versus Wade, either with this case that is coming their way from Mississippi or the new Texas abortion law is likely to land in their lap again pretty soon.
I mean, we're always watching the Supreme Court, David, but is this time different that way?
I think it is a little. There's been a 5-4 conservative majority, but John Roberts, the Chief Justice, really cares about the court and the dignity of the court and the legitimacy of the court. He could now be in the minority in a lot of these cases, and he could be on the left side, because he's been hesitant to turn over precedents. And there seems to be 5, at least, who are much more willing. So he might turn it into be the minority player, and there'll be nobody to try to keep precedents just for the legitimacy of the court. Public opinion polls on the court are not in free fall, but they're in serious decline. The number of people who think it's a legitimate and trustworthy institution is at a low. And the Supreme Court justices are all out on the road saying, no, we're not partisan hacks. They're not. But they're conservatives or progressives, and they vote like partisan hacks. So on the big cases, not in most cases, but on the big ideological cases, their votes are entirely predictable by who nominated them.
And at a time, Karen, when the country is so divided politically, it matters whether the court is seen as partisan or not.
Absolutely, absolutely. And again, I mean, the fact that these justices are feeling the need to go out and say publicly that they are not partisans is that in and of itself is extraordinary. But we will see how these big cases on, not just abortion, but some other hot button issues like guns. And again, this is a relatively young court. And this is the court that we are going to see basically for a generation, potentially.
It used to be people had faith in government and governing institutions. And when that faith goes away, everything is up for grabs. And whether we're talking about the budget, the election, or the court, they all grow out of the fact that people have lost faith in the legitimacy of their institutions.
That's a grim note.
Sorry.
A really grim note.
Face and reality here.
Right. On this Friday night, David Brooks, Karen Tumulty, thank you both.
Thank you.
Now, a story of choreography and community, as a renowned dancer and choreographer continues to look hard at who we are. Jeffrey Brown visits with Bill T. Jones for our arts and culture series, Canvas.
One man, Bill T. Jones, roams an enormous space, telling a story of himself and his country.
Brutality, police, horrors unspeakable.
He's joined by a small group of dancers who enact and move through that story. And then by some 90 others, members of the larger community, filling the space, moving as a crowd.
I know to be black is to be beautiful.
Adding their own stories as individuals. It's called Deep Blue Sea.
The piece is about pursuit of the we.
Pursuit of the we.
Of the we. It's thrown around all the time. We the people. We shall overcome. Politicians use it all the time. This we. Who is this we that you're talking about, considering how fractious our country is and how it has been from the beginning?
Jones has used dance to ask big questions of himself and others since the 1980s, when he and his partner in life and dance, Arnie Zane, first formed a company. Even as their fame grew, their world was devastated by AIDS, which would take the life of Zane in 1988 and so many others. Jones would go on to create more than 150 dances. Early on, D-Man in the Waters, which directly addressed the loss of his loved ones. It's now the subject of a new documentary titled Can You Bring It, co-directed by Rosalind LeBlanc, one of Jones' former dancers. And he's continued to take on big subjects in American life and history, as in a 2009 work on Lincoln. His choreography on Broadway for Spring Awakening and Fela garnered 2 Tony Awards. Last spring, amid the pandemic, he premiered Afterwardsness in the vastness of New York's Park Avenue Armory, a dance of distance and loneliness capturing our moment.
They don't remember. We just don't remember.
Now 69, he returned to the Armory with Deep Blue Sea, a monologue with movement and projection that transforms the space into the sea itself. In it, he recalls reading Moby Dick in school.
I don't remember them.
And years later, realizing he'd forgotten the young African-American character, the cabin boy Pip, who loses his mind at sea.
Now Pip gets so frightened that he jumps into the water.
Jones saw parallels to today's loss of young black lives.
Was it Trayvon Martin or was it Michael Brown in Ferguson? Those things begin to happen so regularly. And as we know in American society, they've never stopped happening, but they suddenly became mediatized. And I was putting together my strong reactions to that with the fact that I had not seen this small little character who was in a way kind of collateral damage on Ahab's ship.
When I was 16, 15, 16, 17 years old.
Another character here, Bill T. Jones himself, 10th of 12 children whose parents were migrant farm workers first in Florida, then New York State.
The young boy that I was when I read the book actually felt the world was full of possibility. I don't know if my mother and father felt that, but I did. And that's what they wanted for me. They wanted a world that was full of possibility. Now, this piece is asking, what happened to that young boy in me, and how are they doing in you as well?
But do you want us to see those depths and those revelations as comments on American history, America, where we are today?
I want them to resound with you. Are you a moral person? Do you give a damn?
I don't remember.
And it's so interesting that remembering is remembering or rearranging, re-putting something back together, membering. So remembering, we all do it as human beings. So I would like to provide you an opportunity to rediscover how that function exists in your life. It has to be entertaining enough, and it has to be full of enough surprises so that you are alert. Because I want to believe, as Dr. King believed, that you are basically fair and kind.
The life of a Negro is still sadly crippled by the manacles of segregation and the chains of discrimination.
Martin Luther King Jr. is another touchstone here, another way to question where we and our country are today.
Art making is resistance. I don't know if we're the most responsible people for managing a city or a hospital or a TV station, but you need us there because we're willing to actually ask the questions and look for answers in unexpected directions.
Inevitably here too, the pandemic. The audience was required to be vaccinated and masked. But for Jones, again, the issues go deeper.
My question, is there a we, seems almost banal now, considering COVID had shown us very clearly, oh yes, there is a we. Not in the high-minded and positive way that you're looking at, but we are heir to literally microbes. We are heir to vicissitudes of health and politics that we can barely name. But there's something else about the ability to sing together, ability to congregate willingly and handle each other in public. That's what my dance world has been. Oh, so there is reason for Deep Blue Sea during the pandemic.
I have seen you describe the pandemic as your second play.
Mm-hmm.
What did you learn that applies now or makes you think about mm-hmm. making art now?
Well, I guess being the son of a Southern Baptist woman, even though I'm an atheist, I do believe there is an over level of consciousness. Art can do that. It might not take away all of people's pain, but it might do something else which is just as good, give people a context in which they can endure. That's it. Can you make something that invites people in to have a shared experience and keep living? Ah, that's it. Can you encourage people to keep living?
Bill T. Jones retired as a dancer 15 years ago. He's back performing now, he says, because this work required his full commitment, and he wanted to gather and help lead this larger community. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown at the Park Avenue Armory in New York.
And his work is such a gift. Next week here on PBS, the NewsHour explores how the lack of affordable, quality childcare is affecting American families.
Childcare in America. For many, it's out of reach.
I don't know what we're going to do. I can't find daycare.
Often scarce and costly.
I kept saying to myself, it's got to be a better way.
A dilemma that sparked a national debate.
Access to quality, affordable childcare.
We can't have everything.
And will impact Americans for generations to come. Raising the Future, the Child Care Crisis, a PBS NewsHour special report Tuesday, October 12th at 10, 9 Central.
And that is next week. And that's a NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here on Monday evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe and have a good weekend.